The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the April 7th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, Marseille, by Ishagul Shavas. For her birthday, Amina asked to go on a trip. Her husband had traveled for work the previous month, and although that wasn't exactly for pleasure, it was now understood that anything which freed them from child care could be considered some type of holiday. Besides, they were trying to allow each other leisurely activities, evenings out, morning runs, a movie from time to time, and recently, nights away. They wanted to find ways of easing back into their life, which had been on hold since the baby was born. It was so simple to slip into that old self, free of obligations. The exchange happened so naturally. Amina was already bored in the half hour she had to wait at the train station in Lyon, even though such time was hard to come by. She bought a coffee and a pack of biscuits, then sat on a bench, scrolling restlessly on her phone. Though this was her first trip away from the baby, who had recently turned one, it did not really feel momentous. It felt rather as if she were putting on a coat she hadn't worn in a long time, whose shape and texture she remembered immediately. She was going to Marseille to meet her university friends, Alba and Lisa, with whom she had studied in England. They were traveling from Madrid and Zurich and would arrive at the rental apartment at about the same time as Amina. It was Lisa who had arranged everything, set the dates, booked an apartment, compiled a list of restaurants and neighborhoods they should go to. Amina and Alba had reverted to their old joke that Lisa was their travel agent. She'd account for their hours of sleep, for every minute in the bathroom. Amina sent her friends a photo of herself, making an excited face on the platform. "Yee!" Alba responded. Lisa sent instructions for retrieving the keys in case the others arrived before she did. On the train, Amina sat next to a woman traveling alone with her baby, who was refusing to nap despite the mother's frenzied attempts. Amina looked up from her reading now and then to offer the woman understanding smiles, meant to signal that she felt for her, that she didn't mind the baby's crying. But from the woman's perspective, she must have appeared smug with her book and coffee. Amina hadn't seen her friend since her pregnancy. They used to visit regularly after Amina and her husband moved to Lyon 7 years ago, to the neighborhood where Amina's husband had grown up. Amina always looked forward to these reunions. She was allowed to be a tourist with her friends, speaking too loud English, getting a little hysterical. But Lisa and Alba were exceptionally busy in the months after the birth. This was what they'd said when they apologized for not yet having met the baby. Their weekends were booked for months ahead. Amina had barely left the confines of her neighborhood that year, and she had thought with some bitterness that Alba and Lisa didn't know what real busyness meant. But she hadn't insisted they come. For one, she was exhausted. And their friendship had always operated in leisure. Long meals, afternoon drinks, dressing up to go dancing. Amina wanted to see them on these same terms, rather than be disappointed by interrupted conversations and her friend's possible lack of interest in her daughter. She herself had never paid attention to friends' babies before. She only surveyed the mothers. She noted the physical changes, their waning interest, trying to project what might become of her in the future were she to have a child. Next to her on the train, the baby had finally fallen asleep. The mother looked at once defeated and serene, her face sagging with fatigue. Amina considered telling the woman that this was her first trip away from her daughter, but she decided against it. She retrieved Lisa's list of restaurants and checked them one by one, already feeling that there wouldn't be enough time. The apartment was a half-hour walk from the station. Amina had planned on taking a taxi, but But it was so sunny when she stepped out of the train and onto the wide marble terrace that she could not bear to waste the bright day. The city lay beneath her, past a long descent of stairs. She took another selfie at the bottom, for no one in particular, because she was feeling giddy. Then she walked, dragging her suitcase, stopping from time to time to take pictures of shop fronts, the boulevard lined with palm trees. She called their names, and they ran out to peer at her over the banister, all three of them shrieking. "Let the festivities begin," Alba announced, taking Amina's bag at the door to the apartment. Lisa and Alba had already opened theirs on the living room floor. The couch was strewn with clothes, too many for the two nights they would be spending together. "We should get going soon," Lisa said, showing Amina the route she'd mapped for the evening. Drinks, dinner, a walk along the sea. "Amazing," Amina said. "I can leave right away." She was wearing jeans and a button-down shirt, slightly stained from the baby's bottle that morning. "Leave like this?" Alba had taken off her trousers. She was picking up clothes and putting them down without trying anything on. "It's our first evening out. I might meet someone fabulous." Alba had separated from her boyfriend some months ago. She'd informed Amina and Lisa briefly of the fact, brushing away the details, as she did with every breakup. She'd known from the start it was just a fling. She'd texted their group chat, though Amina seemed to remember that there'd once been talk of having a child. She could no longer recall whether this had been a serious plan or simply a consequence of Alba's age, at which the question could no longer be ignored. If, that is, Alba even wanted to have a child, she'd always been at once transparent and mysterious about her desires, blunt and elusive. Lisa had taken off her shirt. She was not wearing a bra, and Amina thought that her body had not changed very much since her student years. Then, too, the three of them would gather in one another's rooms and invent reasons to take off their clothes. Had it been a requisite for intimacy, or a silent competition? Full moon gatherings and menstrual rituals, they loved that sort of thing. The way it made them beautiful brought them together. Amina had other close friends, studious types, with whom the body became invisible or irrelevant. It was with them that she discussed serious matters, choices, strategies, philosophies. It was with them that she could be sad. Whereas her friendship with Alba and Lisa demanded cheer, it was carried forth by a constant desire to enjoy life. Alba and Lisa were still without clothes, showing each other tasteful, expensive options for outfits, so different from the flowery, tattered garments they'd worn as young women when they borrowed dresses and shoes from one another for parties. Just like their clothes, her friends' bodies had more purpose now, Amina thought. They were muscled and smooth, made to look that way through discipline and deliberation. She turned away, as if she could no longer examine them on equal footing. It seemed that she'd stepped off the imaginary stage where the three of them had once stood together. Finally, they left the apartment. Alba had settled on a short neon dress, as cheeky as it was seductive. Lisa was wearing a striped shirt and canvas trousers, identical to the neat outfit she'd just changed out of. Amina put on earrings and lipstick, surprised how these small adjustments brought her into her body. Lisa led the way, phone in hand, through several small streets and out onto a wide boulevard, crowded even as shops were closing. "It was so nice," Lisa said, "to be in a city that was alive." "Zurich makes me feel old," she said, when they'd arrived at a rooftop bar overlooking the harbor, bustling with tattooed and pierced people. Her boyfriend didn't mind the monotony of the city, whereas she tried to leave as frequently as possible. She could not bear the thought of so much life passing her by. The bar continued to fill up. Newcomers joined their friends in an expanding group along the terrace ledge. It was as if all the young people in Marseille knew one another. Or perhaps it was the familiarity of youth, the way you could become acquainted over a single drink and spend an entire evening chatting. Let's skip the restaurant, Alma suggested. It's fun here. She'd already pointed out two men with rugged beards. Amina and Lisa joked that they could pick out the most rumpled shirt in any crowd, and its owner would be Alba's type. There wasn't much food on the menu, so they ordered everything. Little dishes of olives and spreads, a platter of cured meats. Amina was starving. She'd woken up before dawn with the baby and had barely eaten anything other than the pack of biscuits at the train station. Still, she could see the charm of spending an evening at the bar. Not that she had any interest in the linen-clad men with whom Alba was now exchanging glances. Alba had always been like this. She found someone to flirt with wherever she went. Very quickly, the attention was reciprocated, and then it was up to her to decide how much she wanted from the encounter. Alba's appeal had less to do with her beauty than with her confidence and nonchalance. Lisa and Amina had spent years trying to decipher it, to understand exactly how it worked. There was admiration in their investigation, and of course, some envy. Perhaps the envy was related to the fact that Alba's exuberant flirtation had been an aspect of their own youth before they'd settled into relationships. Amina could not recall whether she'd always thought this. Maybe it was only after the birth that age had come in such focus for her. She remembered a woman telling her, in the last month of her pregnancy, that she should beware of her diminished desire. This was at a party, and the woman had approached Amina out of the blue to say that after she gave birth to her first child, she had not wanted to have sex with her husband for quite a long time. People had a way of opening up to pregnant women, as if they would forgive or forget whatever they were told. How long? Amina asked. Oh, I can't remember, the woman said. It was years ago. The point is, no one told me this would happen. That's why I'm telling you now. But don't worry, it will come back. It's your life force. Amina had taken the woman's words at face value, a simple warning. But afterward, months after the baby was born, she wondered whether the anecdote was intended to have the opposite effect, to draw attention to the woman's restored passion and mark her sexuality. She hadn't been very young, certainly past her reproductive years, a time when it might seem surprising to talk about desire. Yet she'd seemed fierce and radiant. She'd seemed, Amina thought in retrospect, to be showing off. They were too tired to walk along the port as they'd planned and took a taxi back to the flat. They bought a bottle of wine and a pack of cigarettes from a kiosk downstairs, though none of them really smoked anymore. Just one glass, Lisa cautioned. We shouldn't waste all day hungover tomorrow. But they were too sleepy by the time they'd changed out of their clothes. They wandered off to their beds, murmuring good night. Breakfast was coffee and tartines with jam on a chic plaza. A block away, the streets were lined with fabric shops, elderly men crammed onto benches. Alba said that she couldn't get a sense of the city, of its age and mood. One minute it seemed ancient, then suddenly youthful. It's a harbor, Lisa said. Port towns are always eclectic. Amina liked the sound of that, the idea of old world trade, of people stepping ashore, embarking on adventure. They took a group photo. Alba offered around the pack of cigarettes. They asked the waiter for second cups of coffee. This is so great, Amina said. This may be the best morning I've had in a year. The waiter turned around and tapped her on the shoulder. You can do better, he said in English. You haven't even tried the pastries. He took out a lighter from his back pocket and extended the flame to Alba. When he left, Lisa remarked that he sported both a rumpled shirt and a rugged beard. Well, then, Alba said, I guess I have a type. When he returned with their coffees, he asked if they were sisters. The three of them were wearing flowing black outfits, and they all had brownish hair, though they weren't otherwise very similar. Sisters from different mothers, Alba told him. It was unclear whether he understood what this meant. Are the sisters on holiday? He looked boyish, despite his dark beard. Yes, Alba said. you have suggestions for us? Have you already taken the ferry? He named a place Amina couldn't make out. Oh, you must go there. You drink pastis at the docks and you eat. He said something else she couldn't catch. Great suggestions, Lisa said. We'll totally do that. It was clear she had no idea what he'd said either. A few minutes later, he came back to smoke a cigarette at the empty table next to theirs. It didn't look as if his shift was over, only that he was taking things easy. Are you from Marseille? Alba asked. He was born in Bordeaux, had moved here a year ago. He felt this was where he really belonged. The city was full of energy, he said. His two good friends from home, with whom he had a band, were also in Marseille. You're in a band? Alba asked. Well, we're not Pink Floyd. We just have fun. Would love to hear you play, Alba said. Would love to play for you, the waiter said. When he was called back to work, he told them that they were a happy sight, three women having a great morning. You're all like sunshine, he said. The awkwardness of the phrase did not diminish its charm. Afterward, they egged Alba on to ask for his number. Can I be bothered? Alba stretched her arms dramatically. I mean, I guess it would be fun to have an amoureux in Marseille. Handy for the holidays. Amina remembered Alba's way of talking about men, her tone of idleness. It hadn't occurred to her before that this might be her allure, the suggestion that she was bored with them, even as she was intrigued. When they got up to leave, Alba told her friends to wait for her. She went inside where the waiter was standing at the bar. He jotted down something on a piece of paper and handed it to Alba, who walked out smiling. I asked him for the name of that place, she explained, and the thing we're supposed to eat. It's called a panis, she read out from the piece of paper, and then I invited him for a drink with us. How did he react? Lisa asked. Oh, Alba said, he put on some airs, like he was expecting it. I mean, he isn't as boyish as he looks. He was seeing a friend that evening, but he could meet up later. Amina and Lisa agreed that this was the best arrangement. They'd have a long dinner, then join him for a nightcap. Nightcap for me and Lisa, Amina said with a giggle. His name is Vincent, Alba added, or should I say Vincent? Vincent, mon amour, Lisa cooed. There were two museums that Amina had suggested visiting when they were making plans in the group chat, though they now decided it would be more fun to be outside. They were feeling so jolly, walking the streets. The encounter with Vincent had cheered them up, given them purpose. It was as if they were all going to meet him for a date that evening. And in a way they were. They'd made their impression as a group, and would do so again, until it was time for Alba to take off with him. This was not so different from their student years, when Amina and Lisa would help Alba in her quests. They must have decided that this was a smoother path than trying to compete with her. Any flirtations of their own happened in private, away from Alba. And perhaps Alba was now a bit old for one-night stands with waiters. After all, she'd readily stated that she wanted a relationship. But this was part of the thrill, a reminder they were on holiday. Amina was a little sad to skip the museums. She hadn't been to one in months. Her days were so efficient and practical. She was feeling the same restlessness she'd experienced on the journey, that there would not be enough time, that she was wasting her trip. It was already past noon. Her train back home was the following day. She didn't tell her friends she'd like to go to the museum. They would joke that she was an old lady, as they used to when Amina sat alone on a couch at parties, watching people. Was that what it meant to be old, a spectator to interesting things? Lisa was telling them that they were entering the city's longest inhabited neighborhood atop a hill. Winding, narrow streets were lined with pots of flowers. There were many shops, meant to lure tourists with overpriced hats and silk dresses. So many useless, beautiful things, and they examined them seriously, one by one. They each bought a hat, scarves, beaded jewelry. When they reached the bottom of the hill, the sea appeared before them like a celebration. Alba said that they might as well take the ferry, as Vincent had suggested. Well, I thought that was just an excuse to get his number, Lisa said. We have reservations for lunch. It'll give us something to talk about when we meet him, Alba said. And it's a tip from a local. I agree, Amina said. We might not get to see anything like this. They had some trouble finding the correct ferry. Most people were boarding another one to go swimming at the Calanques. Theirs turned out to be a small motorboat that would take them across the bay. The young boy, checking tickets, advised them to sit in the front so they wouldn't get wet. Soon enough, they were in open sea, pushing forth against crashing waves. Even where the boy had suggested, they were sprayed by water. Lisa and Alba cheered with every thrust and descent of the boat. Amina tried to appear calm, though she was at that moment imagining a disaster and its aftermath. She pictured her husband telling the baby that Mama wasn't coming back, and the miscomprehension on the baby's face. She had tears in her eyes from the scenario. She was annoyed with Vincent for suggesting such a trip. The village, when they finally arrived, was utterly unspectacular. There was a single cafe where they stepped off the boat. Farther down the boardwalk, food trucks were indeed selling panis, which looked something like fried dough. They walked a little way inland, though there was no center to speak of. A bunch of teenagers were smoking on a bench, loud, unpleasant music thumping from somewhere in their midst. "Let's just go back to the cafe," Lisa suggested. "We can have lunch there and take the next boat to the city." There were only chips, which they bought with their pastis. They asked the waiter how much water they should add to dilute the fragrant, milky liquid he'd poured. He was a young boy. At first glance, he looked just like the one who'd taken their tickets on the boat. Perhaps the two of them were brothers. "Depends on how drunk you want to get," the boy replied. He offered them second rounds on the house as their boat was approaching. "Oh, we have to leave soon," Amina said, "but thanks." "Let's dunk them," Alba said. "She knows what she's talking about," the boy said. Maybe he wasn't a mere boy. Maybe they were a little tipsy. In any case, the ride back to the city did not feel so bumpy. On board, a young woman asked Amina to take her photo. She posed seductively, pouting her lips without any hint of self-consciousness. Then she took the phone back and examined the pictures. "Thank you so much," she said. "I'm traveling alone, so I always have to ask." "How do you like Marseille?" Amina asked. "Oh, it's so fun, and this little village was amazing." "What did you like about it?" Alba asked, only slightly condescending. "Cezanne's house, of course," the woman said. "I imagined him painting there, seeing the view from up top." The friends exchanged glances. Was that why Vincent had told them to go to the village? How had they failed to realize its significance? "Where else have you been?" Lisa asked. That morning, the young woman had visited the two museums they had skipped. She had tickets to see a dance show later. She was taking a train early the next day to Spain, where she would meet up with her boyfriend to walk the path of St. James. She was not religious, she clarified, but she would consider herself spiritual. She had recently graduated from university and was taking a year off to travel. Amina was startled by just how much they had learned about the young woman within minutes. She was still young enough that she could sum up her life in a continuous narrative. She hadn't asked them any questions, perhaps believing that her year of travels was something extraordinary. Amina didn't tell her that she and her friends had all done something similar after graduation. It didn't seem very interesting now. In fact, Amina felt a little tired on the young woman's behalf. All those trains she had to take, the cheap hostels, the plazas of every city which blurred into one another. Lisa and Alba had stopped listening and were deep in a conversation of their own. "Wow," Alba said when they stepped off the boat. "You had a lot of patience for her." "She was just young," Amina said, feeling generous now that the conversation was over. They discussed what to do before dinner. They could go back to the flat to change, though it was in the opposite direction from the restaurant. They were all disheveled from the wind, sprayed with seawater. "It's Alba's call," Lisa said. "She's the one meeting her amoureux." "Oh, I'll just put on some lipstick," Alba said. I don't want to drag everyone back for my sake. Vincent can take it or leave it. In the end, they sat on a bench by the harbor, idly watching the crowds. Amina called her husband to check if everything was all right. "Oh, we've had a great day," her husband said. "Someone was on her best behavior. Don't worry about us." She was grateful to him for saying that, and a bit envious that she'd missed out. And now it was nearly the baby's bedtime. Afterward, her husband would pour himself a glass of wine and watch something before going to read in bed, whereas she still had so many hours ahead of her. There was a mix-up with the reservation. They were given seats at the bar until one of the tables cleared. Lisa kept repeating that she wasn't pleased about this, but the waiter did not take her very seriously. They were tired and hungry. The bar stools weren't comfortable. Half-heartedly, they discussed plans for the next day. Perhaps they could make it to one of the museums before Amina's train. "Well, that depends on Alba's night out," Lisa said, trying to lift their group spirit. "You should text him now." "I'll wait a bit," Alba said. "He's probably out with his friend." Amina couldn't tell whether it was for their sake that Alba was demonstrating nonchalance. Still, Alba wrote a message a few minutes later telling Vincent to meet them at the restaurant. The job was done, and their food had arrived. They were all in a better mood. They discussed ideas for another longer trip a few months later. "How about that music festival in Barcelona?" Alba suggested. "Get Amina back on track." "Well, I just need to figure out logistics," Amina said, "but it should be doable." "It's good to see you liven up," Alba went on. "When you arrived yesterday, I thought she's had a tough year." "Really?" Amina said. "I was feeling totally fine." "Well, it's more the overall change." "And?" Amina said. "What did you notice?" "Darling, you're always fabulous. You just need some sleep and maybe a haircut." Amina felt a shudder of annoyance at the bluntness of the comment, and also at its blindness. That signs of her transformation should be guessed at from her appearance. She held back from saying something bitter. She shouldn't make a big deal of it, she thought. This was the way they'd always been with one another. But it was true that she felt, at that moment, defeated. There was no response from Vincent when they finished eating, so they each ordered another glass of wine and asked the waiter for the dessert menu. In the end, they'd never been given a table, and now the waiter was telling them that the seats at the bar were also reserved. "You still have some time," he offered. "Just wanted to let you know." "It's okay," Lisa said curtly. "We'll have dessert somewhere else." After they paid, they walked toward the harbor, which was now utterly different than when they had stepped off the boat. The boardwalk was teeming with people trying to get into bars. Girls in high heels, shaky on their legs. Boys dressed comically like businessmen in blazers and dress shoes. "Where did all these people come from?" Alba asked. The air smelled of perfume and hair gel. "Let's get out of here," Lisa said, leading them toward a side street and up to the shopping avenue they'd walked the previous evening. The stores were closed, the pavements empty. The booming sound of music from the harbor reached them as if through a membrane. They took another turn into a lifeless, dirty neighborhood, though none of them wanted to suggest that they should just go home. Alba's phone buzzed. "Finally," Lisa said, "someone's playing hard to get." Alba was silent for a moment. Her face fell just a little. Then she read out the message. "It would have been lovely to join them," Vincent wrote, but he was already back home. He hadn't met up with his friend after all. If they were around the following afternoon, he'd be playing music at a cafe some distance from the center. He could send them details. "Well," Alba said, "I guess I wrote too late." "Do you want to go tomorrow?" Amina asked. "We could make it if it's early enough." "Can't be bothered," Alba said. "And I can't believe he's arrogant enough to suggest we could come and watch him tuning his guitar on our holiday." "It's your call," Amina said, though the whole thing now sounded a bit pathetic. They turned around and headed in the direction of the flat. "You know," Alba said, "the city's grown on me. I didn't know what to make of it at first. It's so vibrant. And I find it amazing that most people we met today were our age at most. Sorry to break it to you, Amina said, but they were all younger by like a decade. And perhaps this had dawned on all of them, like an answer, though they hadn't realized until then that there'd been a question. It had never been a question. Not yet. It was still their turn. Oh my God, Lisa said. What if he thought we were just a bunch of aunties? Don't be ridiculous, Alba said. I already thought about it. He's at most maybe 5, maybe 6 years younger. Besides, we don't show our age. I was kidding, Lisa said. Obviously, we're not aunties. Still, they were startled by Alba's response, that she'd even considered the question and addressed it, rather than laugh it off as she always did, that she'd made a decision for all of them. Amina tried to recall their exchange at the cafe, the way Vincent had flattered them. It hadn't occurred to her that he might be doing so out of vanity, to make anyone who crossed his path adore him. They'd reached their building. We're definitely having a nightcap, Lisa said. Alba offered to go to the kiosk to get a bottle of wine. Really, they were all tired, though they wouldn't let on, for the sake of their last evening. Then they remembered that the bottle they bought the previous night was unopened and climbed slowly up the stairs. Next, from the A Critic at Large section of the April 7th, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, it's always the other side that's been brainwashed. What talk of brainwashing helps us not to talk about, by Nikhil Krishnan. It wasn't so long ago that respectable psychologists didn't really talk about brainwashing. The term had the slightly kitschy flavor of other Cold War embarrassments, CIA, spy cats, and Reds Under the Bed paranoia. But Google's indispensable Ngram Viewer, which analyzes how frequently phrases appear in printed text, confirms that the past 2 decades have seen an uptick in the word's usage. One potential answer is the rise of technologies suspected of having mind-controlling powers, chief among them social media. Another is the entrenched political polarization of our time. When the cousin you kicked a soccer ball around with as a child starts spouting unhinged certainties about viruses, vaccines, and climate change, beliefs he treats as beyond debate, you might wonder, what happened to him? This isn't just an ordinary disagreement. Could he have been brainwashed? Don't get smug. He's wondering the same thing about you. A few years ago, Psychology Today posted a checklist under the headline, "Your friend might be politically brainwashed if..." The last item on the list, quote, "They assume that everyone who disagrees with them must be brainwashed," end quote. So wait, does entertaining the possibility of having been brainwashed mean that you haven't been? Or is that too easy? Several recent books have taken up the subject of brainwashing, among them Daniel Pick's Brainwashed, A New History of Thought Control, published by Profile, Joel E. Dimsdale's Dark Persuasion, A History of Brainwashing from Pavlov to Social Media, published by Yale, and Andreas Killen's Nervous Systems, Brain Science in the Early Cold War, published by HarperCollins. They share a scholarly squeamishness about the word they are forced to use for their subject matter. Yes, the term brainwashing is silly and unscientific, Dimsdale writes. No one ever meant it literally, but the metaphor is a powerful one. In the new book, The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyperpersuasion, published by Norton, Rebecca Limoff, a historian of science at Harvard, takes a different approach. She is often asked, she says, whether brainwashing really exists. The answer is yes, she writes, without any "it depends on what you mean" by hedging. In fact, she continues, what we call brainwashing is not rare, but common. Of course, words like brainwashing have no fixed meaning, independent of their usage, which can be imprecise and expansive. When France Fanon wrote of colonial efforts at Lavage de Cerveau, in Algeria, or when a commentator in the 70s accused President Richard Nixon of having brainwashed white workers into fearing communist infiltration, the word was gesturing at something, however loosely defined. Yet the term's recent resurgence raises suspicions. Accusations of brainwashing aren't neutral claims. They offer a particular explanation for why someone holds beliefs we find preposterous. That explanation attributes those beliefs to deliberate manipulation instead of rational argument or personal conviction. In doing so, it may recast those with deplorable beliefs as victims rather than agents, deserving of not just condemnation, but sympathy, and perhaps treatment. In the 70s heyday of the cults, that treatment was called deprogramming. Is this what our addled cousins need? A systematic re-indoctrination into conventionality? The earliest appearances of the concept brainwashing, Lemoff writes, occurred in the mid-20th century in the files of the Office of Strategic Services, a precursor of the CIA. The term came to prominence owing in large part to the writings of an American journalist named Edward Hunter. He claimed that it was a rendering of a Chinese phrase, but it may have been, as he elsewhere claimed, a coinage of his own to describe Chinese persuasion techniques. These techniques were most famously applied during the Korean War. As a prisoner of war, Morris R. Wills faced a gamut of privations. He was left malnourished and consigned to filthy conditions amid the ever-present threat of execution. Horror alternated with boredom. Conditions improved when Wills was transferred to what was called Camp 1. The food got better, letters could be sent home, and there were even volleyball games. That was, it seems, an early stage of a procedure known as re-education. Wills was identified as a member of the exploited classes, a promising target for the method. Reflecting on his experiences many years later, he said, "Brainwashing is not done with electrodes stuck to your head. It was rather a horrible, long process by which a man slowly, step by step, idea by idea, becomes totally convinced, as I was, that the Chinese communists have unlocked the secret to man's happiness and that the United States is run by rich bankers, McCarthy types, and imperialist aggressors." The theory behind this method, as articulated by Chairman Mao, didn't sound so bad. People could not be forced to become Marxist, Mao wrote. He recommended instead democratic methods of discussion, criticism, persuasion, and education. An important stage of the process was called speaking bitterness. American GIs, like the Chinese peasants on whom the method had first been tried, had a great deal of bitterness to speak, of racism and poverty back home, and of discrimination within the armed forces. Wills was made to introspect, to write an autobiography. He and other POWs were subjected to hours of lectures on Marxist theory. Faced with the demand to justify the American system, Wills, unable to articulate what that even was, found himself moving in what his captors called a progressive as opposed to reactionary direction. American society was rotting, he came to believe. The Chinese way was the future. He chose not to be repatriated. But where other prisoners who made the same decision were sent to work on farms and in paper mills, he was sent to the People's University in Beijing. The brainwashing process was never complete. Ostentatious acts of repentance were repeatedly demanded. Wills had already had to participate in self-criticism seminars. He was now taught more about Marxism and the history of China. He even witnessed a public execution. But he ended up staying in China for 12 years. Will's retrospective accounts of his experience, once he was back in the United States and in a position to reflect on what had been done to him, are illuminating. It is plain that his Chinese captors had succeeded, at least for a time, in producing a genuine change of mind. He was, as he himself put it, totally convinced. If we take Wills at his word, we might wonder about Mao's claim that nobody can be coerced into sincere belief. In professing this, Mao echoes an old idea within modern European thought, one given its most influential expression in John Locke's 1689 tract, A Letter Concerning Toleration. Locke condemned the use of coercion in matters of faith, the sort of thing we now associate with the Spanish Inquisitors, and among his arguments was that it simply couldn't work. Real belief is a product of the inward persuasion of the mind, he wrote. An effective torturer can make his victims move their limbs as he tells them to, or even say the words, professions of faith, confessions of guilt, that he whispers into their ears. But, quote, such is the nature of the understanding that it cannot be compelled to the belief of anything by outward force, end quote. Locke's point is connected to a more general philosophical claim about belief, that no one can just decide to believe something. Try believing, for instance, that the magazine or computer or tablet or phone in front of you is a venomous snake, or that your coffee mug is made of molten lava. You can cry out if you like, but your steady heart rate will give you away. For all that, you can surely be forced into situations where the desired conviction comes unbidden. Even in the 17th century, people saw the limitations of Locke's view. An Oxford churchman named Jonas Prost agreed that belief could not be coerced directly, but, in his chilling words, the magistrate might lay, quote, such penalties upon those who refuse to embrace their doctrine as may make them bethink themselves. To force someone to believe something requires the concealment of the role that force has played in the process. The brainwashed can't conceive of themselves as brainwashed. To do so would indicate that the brain remains unwashed. They can only coherently describe their experience as one of seeing the light, having their consciousness raised, being red-pilled. As Lomov quotes someone telling her about brainwashing, if the method works, it erases itself. So, if your environment was tailored to exclude alternative views, should we say that you were being forced to believe something? Whether we call this coerced belief is a matter of terminological preference. Ways of making people believe things don't divide neatly into the persuasive and the coercive. The brainwashing model gives the lie to that distinction. As Lomov writes, echoing the psychologist Edgar Schein, it is neither pure persuasion nor sheer coercion, but both, coercive persuasion. The phrase coercive persuasion effectively conveys the core objection to what it describes. It suppresses the fundamental exercise of human autonomy. It prevents you from making up your own mind. If that's the case, would the criminal courts find you responsible for what you do when you've been brainwashed? This question was decisively answered during the trial of Patricia Patty Hearst in 1976. 2 years earlier, Hearst, a granddaughter of the press magnate William Randolph Hearst, was an undergraduate at Berkeley. Her life changed forever when she caught the eyes of members of the Symbionese Liberation Army, an anti-capitalist guerrilla group. They abducted her and held her in a closet, blindfolded, for nearly 2 months. She was raped multiple times by the group's leaders while in captivity, having been told that it would be uncomradely to refuse consent. Shortly afterward, she was offered a nominal choice. Would she join them, or did she wish to be freed? It was clear to her that the appearance of choice was illusory, that she was choosing between joining the group and being killed. She chose life, or, as she later put it, I accommodated my thoughts to coincide with theirs. As with the Korean War POWs before her, mere pretense was not, under the circumstances, a real option. By the time they had finished with me, she later reflected, I was, in fact, a soldier in the Symbionese Liberation Army. A little more than 2 months after her abduction, surveillance cameras captured Hearst robbing a bank in San Francisco, gun in hand. When she was eventually arrested, she weighed 87 pounds and was, in the assessment of the psychologist Margaret Singer, a low IQ, low affect zombie. The Yale psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton interviewed Hearst for about 15 hours and then declared her a classic case of brainwashing. During her time in custody, she repudiated her allegiance to the SLA. When she stood trial for her role in the bank robbery, her attorneys argued that she was a victim of coercion and duress. It was a risky strategy. "I was brainwashed" was not a legally recognized defense. As Lamoff, recounting the episode, points out, one of the psychiatrists who testified as an expert witness for the defense did Hearst no favors by admitting blithely that brainwashing was not a term of any medical significance. It had become, he said, a sort of grab bag to describe any kind of influence exerted by a captor over a captive, but that isn't very accurate from the scientific or the medical point of view. The defense failed. Patty Hearst was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison. After she had completed nearly two, President Jimmy Carter commuted the sentence to time served. It was only on Bill Clinton's last day in office in 2001 that she received a full pardon. Why, Lamov asks, have lawyers found brainwashing impossible to deploy as a legal exculpatory framework? The concept evidently places defense lawyers in a double bind. If brainwashing doesn't work, defendants can hardly claim it as a defense. But if it does work, the defendants are acting on their own beliefs and no longer being coerced. An NPR interviewer 40 years after the Hearst trial put the question in a revealing way. Was she coerced, or did she become a believer? Lamov rightly asked why it couldn't be both. Why not say that Hearst was coerced into becoming a true believer? The problem, as Lamov sees it, is that our intuitive model for thinking about brainwashing diagnoses it as a rational cognitive malfunction. Hence, the mockery to which the brainwashed are frequently subjected. The brainwashed soldiers of the Korean War were thought of as hapless dupes who fell for communism, Lamov says. She invites us to consider a 21st century parallel, the scorn directed at people who lose their savings to a cryptocurrency cult. Lamov thinks that this perception shifts once we acknowledge the role of trauma in brainwashing. Maybe so. But how does this claim square with her broader hypothesis that what we call brainwashing is not rare, but common? If trauma is a necessary condition for brainwashing, as she suggests, it follows that trauma is more widespread than we might assume. Yet, she insists that she is not among the credulous sentimentalists who see trauma everywhere. How common, then, is brainwashing? For recent historians of brainwashing, the issue carries high contemporary stakes. Joel Dimsdale, in Dark Persuasion, relates the disturbing case of Alexander Ertula, who took his life after receiving a staggering 47,000 text messages from his girlfriend, who kept urging him to do so. Dimsdale asked, if you can use social media to persuade an individual you know well to do something awful, can you persuade a wider circle of friends and acquaintances? Given the resources, for instance, troll farms of the kind that state actors can muster, it appears that you sometimes can. The power of such trolls lies in their ability to manipulate the epistemic environment. What was once a lone voice ranting at a street corner becomes a mutually reinforcing chorus. When observers receive the same message from multiple sources, Dimsdale writes, they find the messages more believable, even if they are preposterous. When President Trump tells us that a lot of people are saying, this claim at least is true. There was outrage when it was revealed that Facebook researchers were tinkering with users' emotions, making tiny tweaks to their feeds in what Lamov calls massive-scale emotional engineering. But she notes that the backlash didn't stop the research from running these experiments. It's just made them more reticent about their results. One researcher on the project said that the response amounted to people thinking, "You can't mess with my emotions. It's like messing with me. It's mind control." And, in a sense, it is mind control. But that phrase, much like brainwashing, runs into a tricky question. Isn't everything that shapes our thoughts, desires, or feelings a form of mind control? Lurking behind our unease is a fantasy of total, unshackled cognitive freedom. Any deviation from that ideal gets labeled as manipulation. If we cling to that standard, then sure, we're all brainwashed. But the standard is an absurdity. It's obvious that our minds are shaped by the world we live in, including what others say. This isn't what we have in mind when we talk about mind control. Our idea, instead, is that to be free is not to be subject to the will of another. Lamov quotes an impassioned remark made by the Princeton sociologist Zeynep Tufekci about how online corporate power enlists new tools and stealth methods to quietly model our personality, our vulnerabilities, identify our networks, and effectively nudge and shape our ideas, desires, and dreams. That's the real worry these days. Not just influence, but control that's hidden and personal. Lamov's emphasis on trauma suggests that the concept of brainwashing may not be all that helpful in understanding whatever it is that social media does to its users. Morris Wills was starved and terrified as a POW. Patty Hearst was locked in a closet and sexually assaulted. Contemporary sociology invites us, perhaps rightly, to extend the traditional concept to include the working class experience of deindustrialization and the precarity of the white-collar knowledge worker denied a secure job. The question still arises, what has your average TikTok user been subjected to that is remotely comparable to what Wills and Hearst endured? There's another irony here. Much of what Wills came to believe when he lived in China, that socialism is superior to capitalism, that the United States is an imperialist power run by a class of kleptocratic oligarchs, is shared by many young people today who were subjected to nothing more traumatic than a typical liberal arts education. Their professors would, of course, balk at the implication that they've brainwashed their students. But that's exactly what their critics in the conservative media have long been accusing them of. It's a familiar pattern in our polarized age. The right accuses the left of using the institutions it dominates, the federal bureaucracy, nonprofits, universities, Hollywood, and legacy media, to brainwash the public. The left, in turn, levels the same charge against the right, pointing to talk radio, partisan television networks, and Manosphere podcasts. Each side condemns the other's social media activity. Naturally, no one admits to doing what they denounce in their opponents, but that's to be expected. Persuasion is what we do. Brainwashing is what they do. Does the case of the radical professor fit into this model of malign manipulation? Come to think of it, what exactly should we make of the communists who brainwashed the American soldiers? Or the members of the Symbionese Liberation Army? Mainly white, middle class, and well-educated, who appeared quite sincerely to believe their rhetoric calling for death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people? Were they brainwashed into their beliefs, too? Or did they form them in a way that we all do, as the result of some half-conscious process only half-mindful of evidence and truth? We can grant that the term brainwashing has some utility as an explanation for what happened to certain individuals who were subjected to extraordinary stress and strenuous efforts at re-education. But we needn't reach for it when we seek to describe and understand the masses of people who fail to see what we find clear-cut. There are simply too many other ways of making sense of their beliefs. Heterodox views, particularly antinomian ones, are attractive in part because they are at odds with the obvious. If our beliefs were obvious, how could we use them to distinguish our group from others? How could our beliefs be used to demarcate a social identity? Even in more mainstream precincts, plenty of our avowed beliefs, our diversity is our strength, may not be real beliefs at all if belief is something that holds itself accountable to fact. In ways the philosopher Daniel Williams has explored, they are better understood as shibboleths, tribal anthems, expressions of commitment so deep that we cannot conceive of doubting them. Insofar as these cliches don't express factual propositions, we should not apply to them the explanatory frameworks designed to tell us how people come to credit outlandish things. We may be better served by looking to more conventional human motivations, our desire for approval from those around us, and the way social incentives can reward the outrageous and punish the reasonable. Social media strengthens these tendencies by indulging them and allowing them to operate on an unprecedented scope. Ordinary forces working on a vast scale often produce the effect of an extraordinary force. Although beliefs can be badges, tribal markers chosen less for their empirical accuracy than for what they signal about us, plenty of people do buy into outlandish factual views. It's not a cope or a flex. It's what they take to be reality. How about them? There's a well-meaning, if patronizing, ethical impulse behind our propensity to blame brainwashing for others' convictions, whether they're expressions of allegiance, hard factual commitments, or something in between. Labeling people as brainwashed casts them as one of the damned, lost souls whom we as saviors must redeem. Yet it might be our own savior complexes that we need to shed. The philosopher Karl Popper, writing in 1960, suggested that the temptation to attribute misguided beliefs to sinister manipulation came from a mistaken assumption that truth is manifest. If the truth were manifest, it would follow that the failure to grasp it must reflect the work of powers conspiring to keep us in ignorance, to poison our minds by filling them with falsehood. But even when confronted with a world of people holding views we find baffling, why assume that they are victims of a grand conspiracy or victims at all? Perhaps truth isn't so obvious. Uncovering it demands effort and a bit of luck. Other people will take different things to be true because their paths, owing to differences in diligence or chance, diverge from ours. That conspiracy-minded cousin isn't necessarily a casualty of mind control. He may simply have wandered down intellectual rabbit holes where evidence matters less than belonging. To depict him as a victim of manipulation grants him an unearned absolution. The most disturbing possibility isn't that millions have been brainwashed, it's that they haven't. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.